start managing.
All right, great. Thanks a lot, Lars. It's a pleasure to be here, of course. I've been on sabbatical, so I've been here most of the time of this program, which is it's been great, actually. It's good to come to programs that have nothing to do with what you're doing, because you always learn a lot. You learn one thing, is how to give a chalkboard talk without using any chalk. There you go. You come 10 minutes early and you don't mess up your nails or anything like that. So anyway, so what I wanted to tell you a little bit about is the usual worries about our paradigm. How can we go and falsify this paradigm that nature apparently has saddled us with, which we call the lambda CDM. So let's start, I'll start here from the left of the board, start moving to the right, with some, first things that we need to know in order to set up our jargon, so we can follow this a bit better. Because all jargon is in any new field. All right. So anyway, so let's start with CMB. Okay. CMB with some macro background, it fluctuates, has fluctuations. And can actually interpret those fluctuations, combine them with galaxy surveys, etc. And what we can measure there is a bunch of things. One is the first thing one measures is the fact that there's now, if you take the CMB on its own, there's incontrovertible evidence that there is a huge amount of matter that does not interact with light. It's the first thing. It's very clear. It's like a 7-sigma detection or something. Of dark matter, in a sense. There's no way around it. The universe has things that gravitate and doesn't interact with photons. There's no way around it. And so other things as well, okay? But those are things that are important to us. So actually we can weight that dark matter, and the weight is here, this kind of bio-ignorance plot. The energy density of the universe today has about a quarter of a cold dark matter, cold dark matter. Another 70-something percent comes in this cosmic shear constant. It's a repulsive force that pushes the universe apart. And a little bit is, of course, normal atoms and baryons. So there are some good things about this, some bad things about this. The bad things, of course, we don't know what dark matter is, we don't know what this lambda is, so it's kind of very ignorant. The good thing is that, look at this baryon, kind of relevant, right? Small. So cold dark matter is just basically something that doesn't interact with light, basically with behaviorally collisionless particles. This is just on Newtonian terms, just a force that pushes things apart. It's very easy to simulate. You just simulate this with exquisite precision. A cluster of dark matter on any, actually, it is in the past, I'd say 5 years or so, we've completed a series of simulations, not only us, but many other groups of as well. This is a simulation that have basically established, definitively, what is the cluster of cold dark matter, at least, in every possible scale that you can care of. From the largest scales, beyond the horizon and beyond the Hubble radius, to the smallest scales, smaller than any galaxy you can think of. That is a tremendous achievement, so which is good. We have a very predictive theory in that in our hands.
Julio, can you remind everybody, when you say cold, what you mean?
I'm getting to that. So what do we mean by cold? Thanks, Lars. I have my pointer here. Yeah. What is my cold? I mean, what sort of macro background? It's sort of fluctuations, okay, on a bunch of scales. And now you try to interpret those fluctuations. And you put it in a plot like this, for example. Okay, basically, it's Gaussian field. It's a Gaussian field, a Gaussian noise that has particular frequencies. And you can disentangle what we call delta M over M, which is the variance on a particular scale. Okay, so just to think of, because we haven't thought about this for a while, when I go to the universe as a whole, draw a sphere of a given size, given volume, given mass on average, okay? And I'll place them in different parts of the universe, here, there, over there, over there, over there, over there. The mean, of course, will be the mean mass of that sphere will be the mean mass inside the volume, by definition. The variance is what we care. How much of this thing does the mass inside this sphere varies as I move it around? That is basically the only thing you need, specified on every possible radius of the sphere, as a function of the size of the sphere to characterize the Gaussian field. That's what we call the power spectrum. Okay. This is delta M over M, which is the variance function of M. This is big masses, variance is small. If you take a huge sphere, average, almost get the average, and a very little variance. So on small scales, it's huge, right? These are many orders of magnitude. You can see here, 10 to the minus 6, 10 to the 1. 7 decades. This is, look at the mass scales here. This is a sphere that contains Then the 22 solar masses, one condensed to the 12. And this is now data. The CMB allows us to probe, you know, this large regions here, big things comparable to the size of, you know, bigger than galaxy clusters. And then clusters and galaxies allow to probe this part. And other things like other diagnostics like laminar forests allow to probe this part. So actually, we've been able to probe this delta M over N, this prediction, if you want, of the theory over 10 decades in mass. And this line that goes through here is cold dark matter. It's that only assumed that the universe has is dominated by, or has, you know, has cold dark matter in whatever amount that is, and that you know the initial density, the initial fluctuation. The fluctuation basically is a straight line that goes like this. That's what we call the scale-free, you know, spectrum. It gets modified, of course, because the universe has two scales, how much matter it has, how much radiation it has. When the universe is dominated by radiation, these fluctuations don't grow. They're kind of stuck. That's what that imprints a particular shape. This is actually was predicted many, many years before these measurements were made. The other thing that's amazing is that these measurements are made at very different times of the universe. This is made at a time when the universe is 1,000 times smaller than today. This is only about a factor 2. And this is actually almost in the present. And this is all linear theory. So actually, in order to be able to put them in the same plot, we need to know how the universe has changed in time. The universe, for example, expanded very quickly. You know, the corrections, in order to put them at the same time, this has to be put at the same time, the choice is to make them today. Basically, extrapolate using linear theory. These are small perturbations, after all. This linear theory to put all the perturbations at the same time as today. So the change, and the reason why this, actually, the only way to make this whole thing line on the same line is by assuming that the universe has cold dark matter and lambda. If it doesn't, all these lines actually, one is up here, that one's below here, and so on. That's actually the way in which people like us got convinced that lambda must exist. Not just because supernova are fainter, which is great, got promoted a Nobel Prize, it must be something good must be, but also because this doesn't work. You have, you know, one probe will give you a different thing than others, unless the universe has changed in size in the way you expect from that particular mixture of parameters. So that's quite amazing. Now, but look at this. This is data. This is where data ends. 10 to the 12 solar masses. That's the scale, basically, of a big galaxy halo, like that of the Milky Way, maybe a bit bigger, about that size. Over here, we don't know. But we have a very good prediction. If it's cold dark matter, this should turn over and become like a logarithm. It's almost a flat curve. So we can probe these fluctuations on scales that are much smaller than the big galaxy, then we actually can probe this paradigm. And we, you know, this is a prediction of the model. There are other models, of course, not just cold dark matter. Warm dark matter, for example, just assuming that, you know, there is an initial velocity dispersion to a particular particle and decoupled, and that will basically erase all fluctuations on a scale that's comparable to the free streaming scale at the time of decoupling. And that introduces a particular scale. Below some mass scale, there shouldn't be any fluctuations. There are other flavors of dark matter. Cold dark matter is the simplest in the sense that assumes that this particular cutoff occurs way out there, so we don't care about it. It's economical, in that sense. All right, so we have this theory now, and we can probe it. We have predictions here. We don't have data yet, but so we can actually look into it. All right, so let me move on now. So this is the regime that we care about. The regime of dwarf galaxies, okay, below one big galaxy. That will be the next. Okay. Now, we can simulate this. We can simulate and we've, you know, developed many actually quite sophisticated codes to work on the biggest machines in the world today to do this kind of thing, which is not very attractive here. But anyways, if you put just a Gaussian field in a box, and Gaussian perturbation, and you let it grow in size, you know, like the universe, like dictated by this, by its conventional parameters, you see how that Gaussian field grows. And it grows in a particular way. So it doesn't grow in a you expect things to become, for example, you expect naturally to the things that are almost in equilibrium to become more in equilibrium. That doesn't work. Gravity goes backwards always. You know, that's why stars exist. Right? All gravity goes backwards. Makes things that should be more uniform, less uniform. All the time. So they're no less uniform that eventually a star has to explode a supernova to become uniform. Right? Same thing here. Gravity makes the universe very, very structured, out of nothing, almost. Okay? Those fluctuations grow into these big filaments, the crisscross of matter into these big clumps. And those clumps we call dark matter halos. And that is where we think, you know, galaxies live. The way we think galaxies form is that you have a dark matter halo that attracts these baryons that you see here, this little sliver. Baryons fall into the potential well of dark matter halos, goes to the middle because it can radiate energy, has to fall to the middle, spins around because it has some angular momentum, creates an accretion disk, a disk, any all disks in the universe actually form this way, lose energy, conserve angular momentum, and with a disk, and if you form stars, then you have something going the way. Okay? That's good. You can actually simulate this very well. And this is what one of these dark matter halos, dark matter only look like on a scale, say, megaparsec by a megaparsec. That's like the Milky Way. Looks like an amorphous kind of thing, kind of spherical-looking thing. It's dense in the middle, less dense in the outer parts, as you expect from anything that creates that's form of gravity. And a galaxy would look like a tiny little thing in the middle, or a galaxy like a Milky Way, for example. And also has a lot of little substructures on dark matter. Why? It's because of this. You see, delta M over M, on small scales, is bigger than large scales. Delta M over M tells you the time at which you will start collapsing to make these halos. So if you look at the universe early on, it only has small little things. These clumps are all small. Okay, later on, these clumps are bigger. And actually, to a good approximation, the universe, in the sense of cold dark matter, is always a replica of itself. It's just that what happens as time goes on is that the halos are small, they're bigger, they get bigger and bigger and bigger. But actually, this whole picture doesn't change too much. So it's kind of the same, rescaled in mass or in time.
Can I ask a question about that picture? Is it understood where the filamentary structure comes from a simple theoretical point of view, or is it just a result of simulations?
This gave a decade of headaches to people who had ideas as how this should form. I give the simplest answer, which is slightly incorrect, but I think will do for this particular talk. Imagine you have a spherical perturbation in the universe. The universe is exactly uniform except for a sphere that is perturbed. That's all basically is more over dense. By definition, it has to collapse. It basically will, it's over dense, it will expand less fast than the universe, it will get to turn around, and then will collapse onto itself. Okay? So that is what you expect. That's called the top hat model. An over dense sphere that's uniform in density. Now imagine now that in this universe, that's exactly uniform except for the sphere, I make the sphere slightly perturbed. I make it slightly, squishy on the top, for example. What would happen is that if you look in the small axis, you're closer to the center, right? More mass, you have more restoring force. And now you let this thing go. This thing will still expand away, but on the small axis, it will expand less. On the big axis, no, it will expand more. Right? So in other words, if you look at this later on, this slightly perturbed sphere will become a very elongated thing. It will be very small on this side and very big on the other side. So anyway, in other words, any perturbation that is non-spherical in an expanded universe will grow into something that's very, very, very non-spherical. Right? Gravity is weird. Gravity goes kind of backwards to our thermodynamic sense. So basically, anything that starts as a little perturbation becomes very long. And this is the things you see over here. I was looking at this tiny little clumps when things collapse already, so right, and then they become kind of random. All right, so dark matter halos, substructure, there's a lot of things. So now we say, okay, well, galaxies form in dark matter halos. Now what can we predict? All right, let's go here. We can, in our simulations, as I said, all this is set. We know dark matter, we know how, we can count. Good at counting. Count how many halos there are as a function of mass. Now, of course, there are a low number of small, big things, smaller things, as you expect. Actually, we can do this very well. And this is the mass function, number density of halos of given mass as a function of mass. Okay? In log, of course, is And this is actually the shape of the mass function. It's actually very well, it was predicted even before this was measured. You can do this almost in an analytic sense. It has this particular shape, and it cuts off at large masses, kind of an exponential cutoff. And it's a power law that's actually quite steep on small masses. And I say, okay, well, halos have galaxies. Let's assume each one halo has one galaxy. It's the simplest we can think of. Making this more complicated, but for these surfaces, let's compare then this halo mass function with the galaxy mass function. I can count how many stars the galaxy has, for example, the Milky Way or Andromeda or whatever. I can count that and make the number density, how many galaxies I have of a given galaxy mass, as in stars, for example. And the shape is very different. It actually looks like this, and it becomes very flat, very intense.
Quick next question. What brings the change in the soul?
This is going to be a longer talk than you thought, but why are they different? Right? Why are there different? The reason why in the dark matter cuts off is because this is a Gaussian field. It's always an exponential, right? So it's e to the minus something. So they always expect an exponential cutoff at the end. These are basically the rare, very big perturbations on very large scales. And the rarity basically gets cut off like an exponential in the Gaussian field. This is easy to understand. This is harder, though. Because also, you see, this don't happen at any... This knee here has nothing to do with the knee here, for example. This goes beyond the talk, okay? So this goes... That's a bonus here. We think happens here, the massive end, is the interaction of the supermassive black holes. You see, these are big galaxies. Big galaxies are big black holes. And the idea goes, at least although still, you know, debated this, or actually we don't have any other idea, so that's not debated, but that doesn't mean it's correct. All right? The idea goes that in galaxies that are bigger than something, about 10 to the 12 or so, 10 to 11 solar masses, the big black holes are able to heat up the gas around the galaxy so much that it doesn't allow them to grow bigger than something. That introduces something cut off here.
Yeah, question. From that picture, it seems that there are two different kinds of dark matter halo, right? One that just sits inside some filament, and ones that occur at the intersection of filaments. Are they qualitatively different, or they are all? They are all. Okay. Yeah. There's only one kind.
We can spend a long time thinking about this. There are small differences in topology of how dark matter collapses onto different mass scales. But it's, for all purposes of this talk in particular, they're not very relevant. There are small differences overall. But there are actually interesting differences. And the topology, I mean, this has particular topologies, right? It's not just a random thing. This topology can be studied.
And what kind of distribution galaxies, for example? Distribution of dwarf satellite things, little objects?
Yeah, this is inside this thing.
Uh-huh. I know. So that those are different for different types?
Well, these are regions that have not collapsed yet, right? These are regions that are still expanding away with the universe. These are regions that have collapsed already. Uh-huh. So once they collapse, they prevail in equilibrium, they detach from the universe expansion. The universe can do whatever it wants. This thing stays, at a constant density, constant mean density. So these are things that are moving around, and they actually bear little resemblance to this large-scale geometry of the universe. So anyway, how do we make progress here? We make progress by saying, okay, well, big things are big, small things are small, right? So why don't we just do something? Okay, let's imagine that the biggest galaxies form the biggest halos, and the smallest galaxies form the smallest halos. Let's assume that happens to all mass scales. In other words, I will just match galaxies to halos according to not their masses, because I don't know what the masses are. This is mass in dark matter, this is mass in stars, but according to the density. Yeah, they say, oh, look at these galaxies. There are, 20 per cubic megaparsec. Look at these halos. There are 20 per cubic megaparsec. These galaxies live in these halos. In other words, take a big volume, take all the halos, rank them by mass, big, small, 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 small. Take all the galaxies, rank them by mass, big, big, small, small, and put one in each other. Okay? Provided you have at least as many halos as galaxies, this has to work. By definition, it has to work. And because you look at these numbers, we have lots of halos. So that can be done. There are more halos than galaxies. And that can be done. That's called abundance matching. You want some jargon? There's lots of jargon here. abundance matching. We match things. But that gives us a way. You see it as assigning a galaxy to a halo. And you say, and by definition, of course, this will match the observations, at least this observation. So this gives us a relation between the stellar mass of a galaxy and the mass of the halo in which it lives. It looks something like this. Mass of halo, mass of galaxy. It's actually not a simple function. It's a very nonlinear function, because these things are very different. It looks like this, and then it curves over, and it becomes very, very steep. Interesting. OK, why is this interesting? You see, this very steepness comes from this fact. All these galaxies, the dwarf galaxies that we care about, remember? All these dwarf galaxies are very flat. So when you do this argument, like all these live over here, they all live in the same halo, almost. Okay? This is very flat. Any world, all dwarf galaxies live in the same halo. This is this. So this is very steep one way, it's very shallow the other way, right? So you see, all these dwarf galaxies from Dendera 9 to Dendera 6 live in halos of a very similar mass. That's interesting. Let's keep that in mind. Let's keep in mind the numbers here. This is 10 to the 6 solar masses. This is like a big global cluster. It's a small galaxy, very, very small. Living in a halo of 10 to the 10 solar masses. Below this mass, you see, the galaxies that would form are so small that we actually don't know them. We can know a few in the Milky Way, satellites, but we can't measure them. Right? So actually, almost every galaxy that is known should even be halos. It's another way of thinking about it. In other words, the reason why there are so few galaxies and so many halos is that galaxies live in those most massive halos. And the most massive halos, by definition, are fewer. See, these are good ideas, but we have to pay the price now, actually being falsifiable. That makes predictions, right? I tell you, all dwarf galaxies live in the same halos. I should be able to test this, right? And that's what I will go in the next part of the talk. So to do that, we need to know.
Question? Yeah. At what point does the detection limit for the galaxies make that number drop off? Is it way below where you've drawn on those graphs?
You see the numbers here, 10 to the 7. So that's when we actually know the number density very well.
Very well. Okay.
Very well. So this is 10 to the 6 here. So up to here, yes, we know very well. And here, we can talk about it. But it's not going to change dramatically unless this mass function goes like that or something, which, you know, until you measure it, you don't know. So, but let's not think about that for now. Okay. Anyway, so we know a few things. We need to know a bit more, unfortunately, a bit more now in order to make progress. And the concept that we need to introduce here is similarity. I told you, universe, this picture can be applied in a rechanging scales, the size of the volume, the mass of the halos, at any time in the universe. Gravity has no scales. This power spectrum basically has no scales originally, or very few scales. So the whole thing is almost sort of similar. Same idea here. Dark matter halos are self-similar. So let's think about it in this particular way, because it's the way we make contact with observations. Okay. For example, halos are self-similar in their structure. Take a big halo, one that, for example, holds a galaxy cluster, 10 to the 15 solar masses. Take a small halo, one that holds a small galaxy like this one, 10 to the 10 solar masses. These halos differ in a factor of 100,000 in mass, not 20%, right? Like astroseismology, like to think, oh, it's 10%, oh my God. But here, 5 decades in mass. The mass profile is actually the same, except for the fact that a big cluster is bigger than the other. The mass profile, the way in which a mass in this dark matter halo is distributed from the center outwards, it's all the same. And let me show you this in a particular way. This is what we call the circular velocity profile. Circular velocity, in other words, the mass enclosed in Schrödinger radius divided by mass gives you velocity squared. Take the square root of that, plot that. That's the velocity. Okay? That's basically a measurement of how the mass is distributed from the center outwards in a halo. This function of radius. This is the function for that looks something like this. For a small halo, a bigger halo, a bigger halo, even bigger halo. Okay? You can see all these curves are kind of the same. In other words, you can take this big thing, shift it to the left, and bring it down, and we'll lie on top of this one. The mass profiles of dark matter halos are self-similar. Okay? In other words, scaled, they all look the same. what's interesting, actually, something scale looks and scale, they look all different. In other words, if you tell me the mass within any radius for any galaxy, I can tell you the whole mass profile of that galaxy. So that's a strong prediction. Right? This is, of course, a function of mass. Right? This is a big here thing, this is a small thing. I told you here, prediction is galaxies should, dwarf galaxies should live in small halos, less than 10 to the 10. But imagine this was 10 to the 10, for example. It would tell you that no measurements of velocity and radius should be in this area, below here. But those are strong, those are things we can measure, right? Those are strong predictions that actually can be tested. So instead of mass now, I'll use this velocity. And you know the characteristic velocity, the most characteristic value of any of these curves is maximum velocity. Instead of mass, if I say a halo has a big velocity, or singular velocity, it means the halo is very massive. Okay, it's just a proxy. Of course, you can do this in any other way.
Good question.
Yeah.
Are these velocity curves supposed to be flat after some radius?
No. Okay. No. This is actually the mass profile of cold dark matter halos. It goes under the name of NFW. Have you realized that?
Yeah.
You know my last name, so
yeah, I know that. So why is this? Why are flat rotation curves associated with dark matter?
Very good question. You see what I plot here?
Yeah. Okay.
Log. Linear. This looks very different. Yeah. I get to a little bit at the end, but there's nothing. Basically, this part is the flat part. Actually, it's very quite long when you put it in linear units.
Got it.
That's the only difference, really. But to bring up the similarity, you need to plot this in log. Otherwise, you can't. Linear units are usually only when you go to the doctor or you talk to your financial planner or things like that. It's all deceiving. You want to deceive someone? Use linear units. You want to be really deceiving? Use log linear units. My students come and show me a log linear plot, I just send them back to wherever they come from. Anyways, log, nothing else. It doesn't. Astronomy is log. Astronomy is log. Magnitudes. Remember magnitudes?
Yeah.
Log. Okay. Got my point. All right. Similarity. All mass profiles are the same except for scaling factors. Something else actually is interesting to the last discussion, which is substructure. You see, all these halos are filled with little things. These things, of course, have identifiable counterparts. The satellites of the Milky Way are inhabiting, presumably, these little things. So it's interesting to count them. And that's also actually self-similar. In other words, if I count the number greater than a given mass, and I take that mass and divide that mass, or Vmax, so I say mass and Vmax are the same, by the mass of the big object, the abundance of substructure, how many halos it has of a given mass, is independent of mass. It's all the same. Of course, a bigger object has bigger, more things. But once you take that out, they'll look the same. Substructure, the number of satellites, if you want, is also self-similar in dark matter. All right. That is the introduction, okay? So I'm not sure how much time we have left, but we'll go to the problems now. We now have predictions, we have a little bit of jargon, so we can actually make progress. And the problems that I chose to, people have talked about many problems in small scales, scales have not been probed yet, and the scales that are below that left, that vertical line there, the scales of dwarf galaxies, and I kind of put them together into three groups. Okay, so one is what we'll call the missing satellites problem, or the too big to fail problem. This is jargon. There's a lot of jargon here. So I'll give you a little bit of an idea what that means. Second group is a CAS versus CORE. You may have heard of some of you in talks, you know, we're trying to hire someone or something, we talk about CAS versus CORE, unsolved, big problem. Or dwarf galaxy diversity problems, that's the way I like to call it. And third is a satellite alignment problem. Since I don't think this is a problem, I'm not going to talk about it. So it's actually hard to talk about something, a problem that you think is a problem. So I go to the doctor and say, oh, I feel terrible. I actually went to the doctor, I wasn't feeling well. And the lady here, actually, lady, Alicia, her name, Spanish. Do you want to speak Spanish or not? I said, well, no, really, no, I can't speak Spanish. I'm not feeling well. But I don't feel well either, she said. But what is your problem? But what is your problem? Well, I don't know. Why don't you have a problem, she said. If you have a problem, there was no solution, no pills, nothing. Go home. If you get worse, come back, she said. I'm still here, so she's a good doctor. Anyway, so I think this is a problem, so I'm not going to talk about it. I don't have time anyway. So let's say what these two things. And they're not exactly the same, but I kind of band them together in these two groups. Missing satellites too big to fail. Missing satellites is, of course, has to do with this. Okay. Many, many, many small mass halos, especially very, very few dwarf galaxies. So in any model that's kind of simple, where mass scales with mass, you know, you end up with giant numbers of dwarf galaxies. And in the early models that people came up with, there were actually quite a lot of dwarf galaxies being produced. So if you wanted to plot this, it would end up being a huge overdensity of dwarfs. And that became the name of the missing satellite problem. Mm-hmm. We can solve this problem. This is one way of solving it. Only make dwarfs in big halos. There are not very many big halos. We're done. Right? Unfortunately, that you pay the price, right? We predicted this. No halos. Of course, speaking here broadly, right? No galaxies, no dwarf galaxies forming halos less than 10 to the 10. You can measure that. How I can measure this? This way. This is 10 to the 10. I can measure rotation curves, and the rotation curves will all be above this line. Right? This is here, you can see. I already drew it for you. These are the curves, the same curves. Now I go to dwarfs, and I measure the rotation curves. And let's just plot one point per galaxy. Do a full rotation curve. This is point one point per galaxy to make it simpler here. And the answer, when you actually go in the data, is that there are many galaxies that are below the 10 to the 10 line. In other words, the living halos, which are less massive than this, say 10 to the 9, even 10 to the 3.78. The problem with that is that there are, you see, if I put galaxies that are bright in 10 to the 9 solar mass halos, this mass function goes like n minus 2. A factor of 10 here, 10 to the 9, means a factor of 100 times more galaxies. So my numbers here would go up by a factor of 100 if every small halo had a galaxy of the same mass. Of course, I would say, well, maybe I'll put it in one and not in the other 99. But then you have something to explain. So like, why in that particular halo and not in the other 99? So you see, there's a tension here about the measurements. We measure many dwarf galaxies to be in low mass halos, and the expectations are least of the simplest, most naive representation of the model. Okay. This same problem can be applied to satellites now. And this is what people have done. You can, as I said, plot these things, right? Number as a function of Vmax. Let's do this for the Milky Way. For the Milky Way, we can actually count all the satellites. And above a certain mass, we actually are fairly confident that we counted them all. We may have missed a few faint ones. The bright ones, we know them all. So we actually, and for each galaxy, for each one of the satellites, we can actually measure the mass inside some radius. With the mass inside any radius, I can derive this Vmax, all right, because they're all self-similar. And if I can plot the number of satellites above a certain value of Vmax. Okay, so this is basically how many big halos I have in my big sub-halos, substructure I have in that. And this is what the data for the Milky Way looked like a little bit. It's a number given greater than a given mass, or Vmax, or mass. It looks something like this. The LMC, the SMC, Sagittarius, Draco, Fornax, etc. Actually, you can actually make this plot. So it's quite good. And now you say, let's take a halo like the Milky Way. People thought the Milky Way was like, say, 10 to the 12 solar mass halo, or 3 times 10 to the 12 solar mass halo. And I can make this plot. I can count the sub-halos, one should be mass easily. Right? And this is what happens. The curve doesn't look too awful, but it's offset by a factor of 2 up. There are twice as many halos than what you count in the Milky Way. And this goes for the too big to fail problem. In other words, there are many big halos. There are big halos, right? Why didn't they form stars? What went wrong in our argument that big things have bigger galaxies? So this offset is called the too big to fail problem. It's not presented in this way, but no, it makes sense to present this way in a particular way. It's actually exactly equivalent. This has two solutions, right? One is obvious. These things look all the same once I scale them. If I don't scale them, they don't look the same, right? They don't look different. In other words, if I were to choose a mass for the halo of the Milky Way that's twice as small, all the numbers go down by a factor of 2. So my curve will be like this. Go for all the points. So one easy way to solve this cubic deferred problem is assume that the mass of the Milky Way is smaller, by factor 2. Is that too much for your taste? Is that consistent with other measurements or other estimates? Well, that's a longer talk, okay? But that's one way, easy way to solve it. There's actually an easier way, I think, to solve this, which is, remember, this is very steep. This actually goes like m to the minus 3. It's like m to the minus 2 in differential, m to the minus 3 in cumulative. This is a very steep function. Something's very different in the vertical axis. It actually has to be very small in this axis. So we're able to change the V max by some manner of all the subhalos by a little bit, 10%, 15%, we can talk about the details, but a small amount. I can change these numbers by a lot, right? Take a steep function, move a little bit to the left. The numbers invertically will change a lot. But actually, there's an easy way to do this, okay, which is, remember, let's go back to this plot. Variance was 5% of the total energy density of the universe. All right, small, all right? But what is the contribution variance to the total matter density of the universe? It's actually 20%, so 18, allow me that. 20%, right? This is 20% of all the matter. A little bit of whole energy density, but it's a lot of the matter density. We think that these small halos actually lost all their variance early on. That's another talk, reionization, feedback, etc. If you lose 20% of the mass early on, all the halo is 20% less massive all the time. It grows differently, becomes less massive later on. So these numbers that I plotted here assumed no variance. I took the variance and take them out and run the same simulation, all these curves lift. Shift by a little bit, by about 15%, which is about what you need to fix this problem. So this problem, at least I have good hand-wavy arguments to make it go away. So let's go to this other one, Kasper's score. I don't have very good arguments for that one, so at least that'll be good time to stop and have a question. So what is this Kasper's score and dwarf galaxy diversity? This started early on, okay, when people discovered that, or actually were able to measure rotation curves of small galaxies, and they realized that they don't look like this. You see, this is a very strong prediction here. It's a power law here with a particular slope. It doesn't really matter what the slope is. But people were able to measure this in low and smaller galaxies and discovered the power law in some galaxies they were able to fit. It's actually different. It was actually steeper than that. The physiology, so this actually goes like the order of 1/2. What these people who came up with the Kasper's score issue argue was that many galaxies have a linearly rising rotation curve, proportional to R. That's the scale of the difference. So, all right, that's something we can measure. Now, let's think of, from the point of view of cosmology, what is our prediction? Our predictions are twofold. Not only that there should be this slope or whatever the slope is, but also there should be this similarity. Right? If I give you the mass anywhere, I should be able to tell you the mass everywhere. Right? A halo, once you tell me what its mass is, has this fixed. And the predictions of the models actually are very, very good. The scatter, it's always the scatter, it's only about 20% or so. Right? So in other words, if I were to go to dwarfs, and I take a bunch of dwarfs that have the same mass, or the same V max, or whatever you want, however you want to call it, and look at them all, they all should live in the same halo, first of all, like this, and they should all have the same mass profile, this one. And that apparently doesn't work. In other words, you can go to dwarf galaxies, choose a bunch of them that have the same circular velocity at a large radius, say 10 kiloparsecs or so. They all rotate with the same velocity at the same radius, so they all have the same mass within a given radius. They should all live in the same halo. They should all have the same mass profile. Baryonic component can be a little bit important. This doesn't, my argument doesn't allow for variance, but the changes in spectra are small. Unfortunately, what you see is that that's not the case. Dwarf galaxies are diverse. Diverse in the properties, diverse in the number of stars they have, when they form their stars, how the stars are distributed. If they have gas, they don't have gas. They're a mess. Dwarf gas is very diverse, even at a given mass scale. And cold dark matter tells you they all should be the same. And so cold dark matter predicts something like that, you know, some scatter, you see. But some galaxies actually are much more concentrated, some galaxies are a lot less concentrated. These ones over here, more concentrated, more mass in the inner regions than the cold dark matter, that's kind of easy. Put a lot more baryons, maybe you can shift the, that's the easy thing. The ones that are hard to understand are these ones here. These are the linearly rise rotation curves, remember? Linear rise, and now this is linear. Linear, so I can hide lots of things here, okay? Linear, so these ones, the problem is not that they're linear. The problem is that the light below, the prediction of the cold dark matter alone, these galaxies have, in the inner regions, less matter than you expect from cold dark matter. See, the diversity of galaxies, of dwarf galaxies is one that, of course, allows you, some will be consistent with this cold dark matter prediction. Actually, many are. When people say, oh, dwarf galaxies, they all cut to the score, wrong. Many galaxies are actually consistent with cold dark matter. Some are not. And this is the problem. Not only that they have cores, or whatever you want to call them, is that they have less mass. It's more, I think that's important because it's actually very hard to measure the slope of the mass profile in many galaxies, especially galaxies that don't have, you know, gaseous disks. So it is easier to think of it this way. A galaxy that gives trouble to cold dark matter is a galaxy that basically has less mass in the inner regions than you expect from cold dark matter alone. There are arguments about that allow you to go around this. I say, well, when the galaxy assembled, it did all sorts of funny little things, and the dark matter reacted, you know, formed with little molecular clouds, they expelled, they moved around, the dark matter can pick up energy and expand away. I wrote a paper actually in 1996 about that. And Mark Davis, I don't know, some of you might know him. I presented him in a conference, that was, you know, I just, you know, some of the young postdoc. And my dad is looking at me and said, this must be the lowest point of your career. Interesting enough, the idea has been revived now in the past, you know, few years, you know, papers in Nature, all those sorts of things saying, oh my God, baryons can change dark matter profile. I remember Mark and I paused. It may be that this is what happens, that dark matter baryons, when they form stars, they move around, they expel winds, and you can change the dark matter profile. Unfortunately, this discrepancy is not small. It's actually quite big. Okay. To give an idea of the diversity, at 2 kiloparsecs, take one galaxy here, one galaxy here, this difference is such that the difference in the inner, the mass interior to 2 kiloparsecs by factors of 20, not 20%, not 5%, factors of 20, the scatter you expect for cold dark matter, 30%. So how do you get this diversity? And how do you, on top of that, how you get to have so little mass when you have so much mass here? That is something that I haven't, you know, been able to find, you know, an easy argument or a simple argument that convinces myself, and I don't know, let alone others. Don't convince yourself, you can convince anyone that this actually can work. The interesting corollary of thinking about the problem this way is that, first of all, changing dark matter. People say, oh no, but if you do self-interacting dark matter that's warm and that, you know, sometimes heats up, goes to the bathroom, whatever. You can change that. You can't, right? Whatever you do, you can change dark matter. You can warm dark matter, you can do whatever you want. But you have another prediction. It won't be this one, maybe something else. But this particular diversity, you're not going to get. You will have a different prediction, but it will always be at a given mass scale, it will be a particular model, unless the model is so contrived that, well, that hasn't been published yet. Yeah, Gary.
If the density of the dark matter is approximately constant in the center, doesn't that give you the linear rising velocity?
Yeah.
Okay, so that doesn't sound that crazy.
Well, except that when you actually do the simulations, that doesn't happen. Right? This slope is r to the 1/2. So actually, if you put this in density, if you do log rho here, log r, this actually looks like this. And this is a cusp that goes to r to the minus 1. So, I mean, that can be, but it's not what comes out of cold dark matter, at least. As I said, you can change it. You can make this thing, you know, change a little bit over here by baryons. But this, the effect, actually, when you look at it in quantitative terms, the effect is actually quite small. So it doesn't seem to work. At least I haven't seen this work. So basically, alternative dogma actually doesn't help you. You end up with the same problem. How do you explain the diversity of something that should be self-similar? It doesn't work. So I guess I ran out of space here. If I had another, we're probably going to do something else. But I'll stop here.
Well, so if I had to channel my colleague Josh, he would just say that actually it's most of the observations that are causing that diversity, and most of the observations are wrong. So what is your response to that?
I am not responsible for the observations. So, and I published papers early on. Actually, what was this? I wrote a paper on this 10 years ago and write another one now, which will be a speech soon. That was actually when Argentina went to default last time, I told you. So, and now I write another one. Argentina went to default recently. So I guess every time Argentina goes to default, I write a paper on this. My concern about it, and actually at that time, the observers almost bit my head off. But actually, they cleaned up their act. They went back to these galaxies, they reobserved them, we had multi-tracers, and they always get the same results. Maybe that, you know, still wrong, but it is harder to make a compelling case. And the things that Josh was talking about, some of these galaxies are actually difficult, are, you know, factors of 30% or so. This is a big, big change, right? From here to here, it's not a factor of 20, it's a factor of 10. How do you get that? How do you remove it? 10 times the mass you had from the inner regions. I don't know.
Is there anything special in terms of properties of the galaxies that are below this line? Age or relaxation time?
Relaxation time, all the things are not interesting. The alteration times are very, very long in all these cases. So these tend to be the most low surface brightness galaxies. These ones here tend to have, you know, small condensation in the middle, like a little bulge. And that explains a little bit of this diversity, but not all of it. So the main thing that changes from here to here is the central concentration of the baryons. But the change itself, I mean, unless we know nothing about, you know, the stellar mass to light ratios or things like that, is a lot smaller than you expect from the changes in surface brightness.
Steve? Roughly what is the percentage of the under-dense, the straight line that you've been talking about?
Unfortunately, we don't have data of this quality that's volume-limited. So it all has to do, basically all you can do is go to all the data you have, look at the surveys. Yeah. I would say about, in a range, okay, in range of velocities. Let me show another plot. Let me sketch another plot. I'll plot another thing. Will be with the velocity, the single velocity at 2 kiloparsecs versus the maximum velocity. Okay. Self-similarity. Remember, so I plot velocity now. Velocity v max here. Okay. Log, of course. V 2 kiloparsecs. Self-similarity tells you I know velocity at 2 kiloparsecs. I know it everywhere. I know v max. It's a very tight relation. This is what we expect for cold dark matter. Okay. You can change if you put baryons. I mean, it changes in a little bit. Makes it a little bit like that. Doesn't change very much. These galaxies here occupy points over here. And I would say about in the range of velocities between, say, 60 to 120 kilometers per second, about 20% of the galaxies are in this region that shouldn't be populated according to this model.
A question on the number density for galaxies. Is radiative dissipation feedback included in this picture?
This is data. This is observations, all right? So it is included. Yes.
In comparison between the number density of galaxies and halos on large mass n is not so meaningful, is it? Because, you know, the reason we don't have 10 to the 14 solar masses galaxies is simply attributed to the cooling time scale is much larger than Friedmann time scale. The gas, the baryons inside, you know, those large halos cannot cool to form stars. Instead, you get galaxy clusters.
When you go to galaxy cluster, it's true that, you know, if you put a hydrostatic equilibrium atmosphere and you look at, you know, how long it would take for all the mass to go to the middle, is actually longer than Hubble time. That's I think what you're referring to. Unfortunately, if you go into details, it's not all of it, but 20% can. 20% is a factor of 10 bigger than any big galaxy you've ever seen. All right, so look at these numbers, 10 to the 15, 20% variance. These have, 20 to 14 variance. If only 10% of that goes in the middle, we get a 10 to 13 solar mass galaxy. They don't exist. Even the biggest CP galaxies are a few times number taller. So we have a factor of 10 to explain. The argument is correct in the sense that not all the variance go to the middle, but it doesn't matter. Even if 10% go to the middle, we have a big, big headache already.
Marty. The theoretical curve on self-similarity is...
This one here?
Yeah. Is that... how does that depend on the assumptions about the dark matter interactions? For instance, if there are different components with different interaction strengths, would that still come out?
Yeah, this assumes that there are no interactions. This is what you get for cold dark matter. Basically, the only interaction is gravity, and it's a collision. You have a collisionless fluid that collapses out of a Gaussian noise field. So this is what you get for cold dark matter. If you get an interaction between particles, now if some particles were to scatter on small scales, then of course you can change this picture. And that is what some people argue to fix this, right? Oh, if I make an interaction, what will happen? Right? Make an interaction, particles now can thermalize in the center. Right? This cusp that you see over here actually flattens out. It goes to a constant density at a radius where basically interaction crossing time is about the age of the universe. There's one way you can do this. So you could adjust the parameters to fix this and make this work. But how do you get the other ones then? How are you going to get this one and this one and this one? And also, the way this scales with mass doesn't seem to be right. This only happens in galaxies between 60 and 120, but not others, for example.
Also, really, that cross-section was roughly Thompson, right?
The cross-section is about 0.1 grams per centimeter squared.
It's about Thompson.
Yeah, so
that's surprising. Looks like an interaction, right?
I think people, it's not my field, but people argue that you can still hide this away in the particle physics.
Great, thank you so much.
All right, thanks.